Kia ora, good evening. My name is Dave Moskowitz. I am the Jewish co-chair of the Wellington Abrahamic Council of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And I want to welcome everyone here tonight to discuss this really interesting and important topic, which is diversity within our own religions. Because when we think of a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim, we immediately conjure stereotypes. And as it turns out, these stereotypes only represent a really narrow fraction of our religious communities. And I know, speaking personally from within the Jewish community, we're all very different. We're very argumentative. We like to argue with each other a lot. And I know that there are many, many different strands of diversity within each religion. And diversity has many axes. Religious diversity has many axes. There is ethnicity. Many of us come from different ethnic origins within the Jewish community. I know there are a wide variety. And I remember someone telling me that there are over 50 different nationalities represented in Islam at the masjid in Wellington. So a very, very wide variety of ethnicities. There's gender, and given the full spectrum of gender and gender identities, each of our religion has many people representing many different strands. There's political beliefs, there's disability, and there's even different religious traditions within our own religions. Certainly for the minority religions, where we have very small communities, each one of our places of worship actually tries to shoehorn in many different religious strands into one box, and we all try to get along with each other, even though our beliefs are slightly different. And so I'm hoping that tonight we will get introduced to maybe some stereotype-breaking ideas of people who are different from our own religions, and we can learn not only about other people's religions and that diversity within their religions, but also more about our religions ourselves and question our own religious beliefs. So the way the evening is going to work is that we have three Jewish speakers, two Christian speakers, and three Muslim speakers, and they will be speaking in that order. Each speaker will have approximately 3 minutes to just introduce themselves and how their own diverse perspective on their religion differs from maybe what most people would think is the mainstream, and talk about how they relate to others. And then after each one of the speakers have spoken, we'll set up some chairs on the stage here, and we'll have a panel discussion. We can have the speakers talk amongst themselves for a bit, and also field questions from the audience. Are there any questions before we begin? Excellent. So I would like to start by inviting Mona Williams to the stage and to give us her perspective. Thank you, Mona.
Thank you. I don't know if you can hear me clearly.
Yes.
Thank you. Although my name is Welsh, Mona Williams, I'm not Welsh. I've come from the old British Guiana in South America, next door to Brazil and Venezuela. It used to be a British colony. It is now called Guyana. It's independent. Historically, it began in slavery. And that has everything to tell you about the way that I worship and the way that we worshiped as a family. During slavery, one of the rules that the British made was that it was called the suppression of native religions, so that whatever was the religion that anybody came with from the African continent, it was banned and you could be killed for practicing it. You had to be Christian, of either Anglican or Catholic, and that's how you got to school, or that's how you were able to get a job. And so most people decided that in public they would be Anglican and Catholic, but in fact they still were doing whatever was the African religion that they had. So it might be called voodoo or whatever it was called, but that is what you really practiced at home, and then in public you were ostensibly Anglican or Catholic. In our household, we were Jewish, and we weren't allowed at home to tell anybody that we were Jewish. Other people who were Jewish, we all knew we were Jewish. And we kept circumcision, we kept the food laws, we didn't eat pork, we didn't eat shellfish, and we didn't eat any fish that didn't have scales, like skinfish. We worshipped on a Saturday, and we kept all of the big holidays, but it was always on the quiet. And one of the things that happened was that because we always had to be very careful if anybody found out that we were worshipping differently, we had to be Jewish in the Old Testament sense of things, but that was not the same as European Jews who had come out of Israel after 76 AD when they were exiled. They were defeated and by the Romans and then taken right out of Israel, and they were spread around Europe. So the kind of Judaism that I found when I came to America and to New Zealand was very Europeanized, but ours wasn't. And the reason why we had to make sure that we kept to the Old Testament way of doing things was that that was safe. If we were caught doing anything, we could always say, well, this is the way it's done in the Bible. So I'll take the biggest festival, which was Passover. And in the Bible, it says that you must practice that by telling the story. In New Zealand, it's read. You have to read the story of the Passover. I've never had it read. It was always somebody talking. So I'll show you a little bit of how it was done. I've got the props. So in the Bible it says you have to be ready to go out, and you had to have your staff in your hand, you had to be dressed with your sandals on, and you had to eat the Passover feast standing up. And it wasn't in the house. It was always in a compound, and you had a fire. And on the fire, you had a lamb that was roasted. It was like a barbecued roast. We never served anything cooked or stewed. It was only the roasted lamb. And we had the unleavened bread, but that was roti, exactly like Indian roti. And we understood that it was unleavened because you didn't have yeast in it or baking powder or baking soda or anything like that. And we ate it with a very bitter, bitter herb. And it's called, we now call it Japanese bitter melon. But if you go to a Korean store, you better say Korean bitter melon. And I think if you're from India, you call it Kerala. It's absolutely bitter. And we didn't have rum. So everybody knew that it wasn't, we'd all be asked, what are you doing? I heard last night you had drumming and people were dancing, and we do dance in the open, and we'd be singing and dancing and waving and flags. And I've gone to Passovers in New Zealand, and there's no dancing, there's no standing around, there's no telling the story. There's no staff in your hand. There's no drumming. And it's not outside. And there's no roast lamb. But all of that is absolutely biblical. And so that's my idea of Passover. And is there anything else I've forgotten? We used to have wine, but it was rice wine. And then you had to put the rice wine on the fire and warm it. You never boiled it. But if you warmed it, all of the alcohol was driven off. So it didn't violate the law that you couldn't have things that were brewed. So I think that was it. And then we only met, and we danced, and we sang, and all of that, jollification. And then you left before dawn. So you just were like a spirit, and you faded away out of the compound so that nobody could be sure who was there. And if you were asked, well, what was the celebration? You always would say, oh, it's something, you know, I'm sure it's a birthday or something. But everybody knew it couldn't be a birthday, because for a birthday, you'll invite friends, and nobody was invited. And you'll also drink rum. And we never drank rum for Passover. It was always rice wine that was warmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona, for giving us really a beautiful example of how various different traditions from our own religions can really enrich us. And Mona has really brought a lot to our congregation in terms of her practice and the stories that she tells. So thank you very much. I'd now like to invite Yuval up to the stage and tell us your story, Yuval.
Wait, wait until after what I have to say. Maybe the applause will be less. No, I'm kidding. Kiro Kotao, Kora Magan Temonoa, Ko Yama Tichon Temoana, Ko Takatapui Toko Iwi, Ko Natai Hurai Toko Iwi, Ko Temple Sinai, Tefanganui Atara, Fare Karakia, Ko Mali Toko Mama, Ko Kalman Toko Papa, ko lui hoa hera marena, ko Yuval Zalkni le toko inoa, tena koto katoa. Thank you for inviting me to give my kururu here tonight. And I think the 2 minutes starting now, no? And yeah, I want to also acknowledge Mana Fenua for hosting us in on the land. What it is to celebrate myself as Jewish, and I think it's how I celebrate myself as a Jewish person in Aotearoa. It's a different question than how I do it in my motherland, in Israel. But it have the same basic rules, and I found myself, let's start with celebrating myself. Also, I have a lot of identities. Intersectionality is something that exists in me. I'm Takatapui, which is rainbow, part of the rainbow funnel. I'm married to Takatapui, who is Maori trans person, and Pakeha as well. Myself, my mom is from the mountains of Morocco, and my father is a family from Holocaust survivors from Poland and Germany. I was born in Germany, so how I celebrate myself is very diverse, and I have luck that my Mahi is also doing a lot of diversity in a great organization or government organization here in Aotearoa. And I think how I celebrate myself is also I getting a lot from my community, from my Jewish family, and I try to give sometimes back. So like we have our holidays, but the holidays is just a part. So every Friday we have Kiddush, which is like dinner and welcoming the Shabbat and saying the blessings. Also my Maori fano is also, so we're doing karakias, so we're blessing the food. Oh, Maori way is more welcome the kai. And the Jewish part is blessing the food. And in Judaism we have do and don't do. And we have the Kvod Rab, the rabbi here, they can always correct me if I'm wrong, which sometimes I need to, I'm trying to avoid not to say gods that I shouldn't say, or not to do stuff that I wouldn't do, like avoiding to go to places or to say some stuff that isn't a bit forbidden in our religion. So I found it always to walk between, and it's very interesting, and it's also suddenly the appreciation that I have to my mother tongue, to Hebrew, because it's not obvious anymore, and suddenly I became the person, people asking me questions, something that I wouldn't be in Israel, the person to ask a religious question. But because I have the indigenous knowledge and the opportunity to search resources that not everyone can approach, and also because my intersectionality, I became to be a person who get asked or get to lead stuff in my community. And so I think for me, celebrating my Judaism is actually sharing it with my community. It's being a part of a greater reason to be Jewish. It's an honor. It's like my queerness. It's like sometimes it's very uncomfortable, and sometimes it's dangerous, and sometimes you feel that you're not the most popular person in the room just because who you are and who you were born, but it's so rich in culture. I would never give up on it, and like if I wasn't married, I would marry you, Mona, but it's just amazing to be able to share the stage and to the room with people like that. And so, yeah, my celebration is to be a part of the community. And, yeah, I think, thank you again for having me. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yuval. I'd now like to invite Yoel to come up. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Mike, yes, I'm Jewish, but when I came here about 20 years ago, from my own community, I was the first Indian Bene Israel Jew to come here with my family and live in Israel. I lived in Israel for 15 years and then came here to about 20 years ago. Now, in India, there were six, or are six, different Jewish communities, very separate from each other, plus together. One is the Cochini Jews from South India, who lived near Cochin and Kerala. They're known as the Cochini Jews. My community, known as the Bene Israel, lived near Mumbai and the coast, mostly. Then we have the Mizoram Jews, which is the Bene Menashe, lived eastern India, near the border of Thailand, Burma. Then you have about the 17th or 18th century, the Iraqi or Baghdadi Jews, as they are known, came to India, mainly settled in Mumbai and Calcutta. Then lately there's also a fifth community, which is just south. When I say just south, it could be driving about 5 to 10 hours of Hyderabad. They were the Andhra Jews, which is known as Bene Ephraim. Plus, there were the European Jews who did come during World War II, and a lot of them settled down in South Bombay. I belong to a traditional Bene Israel family. For me, I first came across or heard about anti-Semitism is when I went to Israel, and I went to Yad Vashem and things like that. For me, as a Jew growing up in India, I never faced it, and I did not know what it meant. So the incident which happened in 2008 for me was one of the most saddest days in my life. For a Jew to get killed in India for being a Jew was, I sat and cried. It was absolutely devastating for me, having never faced it before. But still, the community has moved on from there. It is thriving. Now let me talk about a little of traditions, because Ben Israel's landed in India about 2,500 years ago, before the destruction of the Second Temple. This is What I'm talking to is stories which have come down from generation to generation. The Ben Israel community, for the day before a couple get married, have adopted a very Hindu custom of using spearing the bridal couple in turmeric. And that's a very Hindu custom which has come into the Jew Ben Israel community. It's nothing, it's only the smearing and sort of that the couple would look beautiful. And then, of course, the couple have there was a big party, and they would afterwards apply henna, which is a Muslim custom, which came into. But the unique thing about the Ben Israel community is one thing they did is they applied henna on the first finger, because that's where the bridegroom puts the ring on the bride's finger, the first finger. And that would be covered totally with henna. The bridegroom also would put the henna there, but it's the bride which wears the ring. So that was two, the Hindu and the Muslim customs which came into the Ben Israel community. But it was just as more for the fun of it than the wedding. Weddings, the bride wears a bridal gown in white. Most Ben Israel brides wore a white sari with a veil, but she wore a white sari, not so much of gold, more done in silver, but it would be white. That's the sari coming into the Ben Israel customs. There's a very, there are Moroccans also have it, invoking the blessings of Hashem through Prophet Elijah, where they would have what they call a malida. They have a very similar one is in the Moroccan community. The Ben Israel community would do that. They would prepare something of beaten rice, and it would be prepared more to invoke the blessings through Prophet Elijah, because the Ben Israels believed that Prophet Elijah visited the Ben Israels in their in this place before he ascended to heaven. Normally they would do that, invoke that when there were weddings, birth of a child, went into a new home. So it's only for, it is, or they started shopping for the bridal couple during for a wedding, you would invoke these blessings. So there would be good times. The Ben Israel community were very strict about kosher. They would eat kosher meat, goat, sheep, chicken. Funnily enough, most of the Ben Israels would avoid beef, except they would eat it once a year to distinguish that they were different from the Hindu, and they were not Hindus. They did not worship the cow, but they would avoid eating that in public because the Hindu had given us a home there, so we accepted that, and therefore that was important to us. I will mention something which is very significant for me as a Ben Israel, is that Pia Mona also mentioned it, fish. We only ate kosher fish. Why I say that is because one of the big Rambam's brother found out by looking at the women folk segregating the fish at the after the boats came in, and he realized that the women were following the Jewish custom of throwing away the non-kosher fish and accepting only the kosher. fish. And that's how the Jews, Venezuelans, got back their religion. In the sense, they had lost all books. Of course, that's a big different story that for another time. But that's how it became stronger, the religion. My experience in New Zealand, I'm often asked, did you convert to Judaism? Of course, I ask, why do you say that? It's because you don't look Jewish. As far as I can remember, I've always been Jewish. I've traced back to my family tree. On my mother's side, I've gone back 9-10 generations, and I've connected that. They've always been Jewish. My dad's side, I've gone back about 6. I'm still researching. It's always been Jewish. But we're also Indian. But my family history is another story. But that's what I wanted to say. Because a Jew doesn't... People are always stereotyped. And for me, all religions are important because I grew up in a beautiful place called India. I've Hindu, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish friends. And we all live together in a lovely place. Like my first name, in India we never hid under a different name. We always had only a Jewish name. I was always known as Yoel, in the Jewish community as son of Reuben. And Samson is not exactly, it's a surname now, but it's never been a surname. It was taken by my grandfather, whose grandfather was Samson. Because the Jews in India actually always went Yoel, son of Reuben, or whatever it was. And surnames was only when the British came. And first it was the village where you came from, but being an Indian Venezuelan, you were in a special, different, even though we are a colony, you were considered different from the Indians being Jewish. You got certain privileges, and so, therefore, my grandfather changed his name to surname to Samson, from his grandfather's name. I just say some small... About a year ago, the Indian Jews of Australia and New Zealand, is only me at that time, started an association called the Indian Jewish Association for Australia and New Zealand. I happen to be the chairperson of that now. We have started this organization to get other people to know about the beautiful life we had in India. Just about 2 weeks ago, we have started and we've got an exhibition of art by an artist called Jay Warkirka. I'm sorry, I don't remember his name too well, but Jay from the States, who's done art on water paintings of the Jewish synagogues and sites. And the exhibition was opened in Sydney, and we had a beautiful, I hope to get that same exhibition to Wellington, hopefully in the near future. I hope I got you interested in my beautiful story of the Jews of India. There's a lot of stories in that, but in what we are saying today, I think this is, I hope, has tickled your interest. And thank you for inviting me to this lovely meeting.
Thank you, Yoel. I feel very tickled. It's great, and I want to learn a lot more. And hopefully we'll have time for questions and discussion during the question and answer phase of tonight. But we'll only have time for that if the speakers stick to their 3 minutes and relatively brief. So I'm just asking the other speakers to please be succinct. So that finishes our Jewish tranche for the evening. And we will now move on to the Christians. And our first Christian speaker will be Jenny Dawson. So, Jenny, please come up.
Perhaps I will not be as fascinating as our previous speakers, but maybe I will. My name is Jennifer Mary Dawson. And when I say Mary, I'm sure the Catholics amongst you relate to that and think I was named for the mother of Jesus. In fact, I was named for Good Queen Mary, who was the Queen Mother when I was born, I think. And she was a very upright woman that my mother thought I would become like. I'm not like Good Queen Mary. So, kia ora tātou, iho mā. And I've been asked to speak about, from the Christian Anglican perspective. I guess I want to start by saying I'm an Anglican, I'm a Christian because I was born into it, and I'm probably an Anglican because I was born into it. I had a few years when I was looking around elsewhere, but from what I've heard already tonight, I probably didn't look wide enough. I didn't really look outside the mainstream that I thought I knew. But Anglicans are not all like me. And that's part of what I want to say, because there are only two of us speaking tonight. Statistically, the typical Anglican today is a black African woman aged about 30. So I'm not typical at all in the Anglican communion. And about 15 years ago, I went to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. Every time they hold that, every year, and each country in the Anglican Communion sends a delegate, and I was the one from Aotearoa, New Zealand. But there were people from Uganda and people from all over the world, from different parts. Most of the Anglicans in this world live in countries that were once part of the British Commonwealth. So it's been quite an English sort of a thing, which we'll come back to. My father was a Scottish Presbyterian and my mother an Anglican born in this country. But the church that I know here is not like the one I grew up in for a number of reasons. What's happened in the Anglican Church in this country, in these islands, as we tend to say, is we have become a three-tikanga church. And I'm sure the other Anglican here, who is it who's speaking? Isn't it? We've got another speaker tonight, haven't we? Or just me? Mother Mary. Perhaps I do need to say this then. In 1992, the Anglican Church in this country decided to face how colonial it was, and to develop a new constitution based on the Treaty of Waitangi. And so we are now a three-tikanga church, which has nothing to do with geography or ethnicity. So you can be part of Tikanga Pākehā if you are Chinese or Māori or English-born or whatever. You can be part of Tikanga Māori if you want to be part of the cultural life that is Māori. And you can be part of Tikanga Pacifica or Polynesia in the same way. The largest Polynesian community in the world, of course, lives in Auckland. And so that's where most of the Anglican Polynesians are. But I have been very much part of the development of that three Tikanga church idea. And it's about learning to be partners. So we are all equal, even though the numbers are not like that at all. And the General Synod, which organises our life, has to have everything agreed on by the three different streams. And I love that, because it's taught me a lot about the partnership that the rest of this country is also working on. And it seems like, in some ways, the Anglican Church is at the cutting edge of that. We're not always at the cutting edge, but I think on treaty stuff, we've begun to do some of our work. So I'm an Anglican, and I'm part of Tikanga Pākehā in the Anglican Church in Aotearoa, New Zealand and Polynesia. A friend of mine, Bishop Penny Jameson, once was talking with me when we were trying to help Tikanga Pākehā, the European kind of side, the colonising side of our church, to learn what its identity is, because this country has been divided into seven Anglican units that didn't work together for a long, long time, for over 100 years. And Penny said to me, you know, to get Tikanga Pākehā trying to be one tikanga instead of seven dioceses is like trying to get the seven dwarfs to be Snow White. And there's an element of that. We are the Snow White bit. But we participate as partners, and that means a great deal to me. One of our treasures is something that people sometimes refer to as the Anglican prayer book. It's not the Anglican prayer book. It is a New Zealand prayer book. And it was written by us for anyone who wants to use it. It contains sections, a lot in Māori, a lot more in English, and some in some of the Polynesian languages. And it's greatly loved, and I'm very proud of it because I was the 40 years ago token young lay rural woman working on the commission that wrote this. So I was responsible for a lot of the inclusive language and all the names for God that we found in the tradition of our Christian church that are not about Lord and Father. There are many, many names that we use for God, and yet the commonest ones you hear around Christian circles are Lord and Father. I hardly ever use those images. I hardly ever use he for, I never publicly use he for God, if I can avoid it. I never publicly use she for God because it will turn some people off. But I prefer the pronoun you for God. I'd rather talk to God than about God. So that for me came out of writing this book. If you want to know what Anglicans believe, we say worship with them. And so come and worship with us and find what we believe, because we don't have any other doctrine really except what we say in our worship, which is why priests like me are supposed to do exactly what the book says. We're not supposed to make things up. But I was doing a wedding in January, officiating at a wedding using the prayer book, and I started to read, and I said, we have gathered here to celebrate the marriage of Josh and Diane. Marriage is the promise of hope between a man. And I stopped. It says, a man and a woman who love each other, who trust that love, and who wish to share the future together. Now, where I stand within the Anglican churches, if I could marry a same-sex couple in our church, I certainly would. The bishops have not yet allowed us to do that. But I didn't want to read those words, which to me exclude people who are pretty important to me. So I said, marriage is the promise of hope between two people who love each other. And after the ceremony, I just happened to be talking to somebody I'd met 40 years ago, and he told me he was a gay man, and I thought, I'm really glad I used those words that actually allow some hope for change. Because my understanding of the Christian church and my part, particularly the part of it that I know, the Anglican bit, is that the parts of the church that pay most attention to getting worship right, often in an incredibly beautiful way, are also the most progressive in their thinking. So St. Peter's on Willis Street, for instance, would be like that. The parts of our church that are very light on doing things properly in our worship and who make the biggest part of the service would be the sermon, which could be really, really long, they tend to be the most conservative socially. So if you hear people from the Christian church speaking out on an issue, you could usually pick what they might do when they worship. And the prayer book shows you that I think worship's really important. And I am going to finish with a story because I haven't got another Christian speaker. And it's a story that comes from, I think it relates to a story in the tradition of all of us, each of our three faiths traditions. But you won't recognise the little girl from any of the faith traditions. It's a story that we read in church from the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, a couple of weeks ago on Pentecost. But it's been changed by a rabbi called Mark Gelman into this story. It's called, Does God Have a Big Toe? So you won't find it in your scriptures. That's something close enough. A little girl called Rinna. Rinna had a really big question one day, and she went to her mum and said, Mum, does God have a big toe? And mum was busy, as mums often are. And she said, No, I don't know. Go and ask your grandpa. So she went out to the garden where grandpa was hoeing away and doing some work. And she said, Does God have a big toe, grandpa? What's that? Does God have a big hoe? And then his friend Fred, who was working with Grandpa, said, I think she said, does God have a big toe? And we don't know, but I'll go and ask the king, because I know the king. So Fred went off to the king and said, Arina wants to know if God has a big toe. And the king didn't really know either. So he gave orders for a huge tower to be built, higher than you can imagine. So he could climb up and see if God had a big toe. And everybody was commissioned and compelled to build the tower. All the people were there working on the tower. And it went on and it went on, and all the energy went into the tower. Everybody was there with all their skills. And God got worried. God said, they're neglecting gardening, they're neglecting cooking, they're neglecting growing things. Everything's going into that tower. And God did something very strange. The next day, when they came back to work, somebody dropped something and said, Arigatou! And somebody else said, Aramai! And somebody said, Silver Play! And they suddenly realized they couldn't understand each other. And they were horrified, and they pulled away. They withdrew from the people who weren't talking like them. They didn't want to talk to them. And people rushed away from each other. And there was so much division, even before morning tea time. People didn't know who they were anymore. They gathered quickly with people, the few people who talked like them. And by the end of the day, Arina's family were getting onto a cart with people who talked just like them, and they were leaving town. They saw other carts going in other directions with people who were leaving town. And Arina couldn't understand it. But as they drove away, she said to her mother, Mum, does God have a belly button? Now that story's really, really important to me. Because actually all those people were working on the same tower. And we need people to be working on different things. And I think that's why we need our different traditions.
Thank you, Jenny, for that lovely retelling of the story of the Tower of Babel. For modern times, and your point that our religions are all a work in progress. We have our core beliefs and our corporate traditions, but really every generation and every locality and every identity adds their own bits on and embellishes them for the betterment of all. I would now like to invite Ben Thola to come up.
Bulavanaka, Kia ora. My name is Ben, and I'm originally from Fiji. I'd like to thank the Wellington Abrahamic Council for the opportunity to be here today and share with you all on how Christianity has impacted and influenced my ethnic belief as a Fijian. The foundations for someone being a Fijian, an indigenous Itoke like me, is deeply rooted in the following: identity, land, spirituality, respect, silence, honor, and hospitality. Due to time, I won't be touching on those all the seven fundamentals. But if you enter a Fijian community or a village setting, respect, silence, honor, and hospitality, you'll be able to find these fundamentals in a Fijian village setting. This is because people are so interdependent, and the need to respect, honor, being silent and hospitable allows them to operate communally and collaboratively in order to be effective in the general well-being of its people. Whilst respect, honor, and hospitality are common knowledge and easy to follow and understand, I want to dwell a bit deeper in the word silence. In Fijian, it's vakanomundi. Unfortunately, I've heard how foreigners think the culture of silence the indigenous have is quite challenging because we are not saying or expressing our thoughts, and thus there is a false image or response is created. Whereas this culture of silence is actually the indigenous people listening and listening well, so that then a well-formulated response can be thought through, which will add value to whatever is being discussed. Also, it is for the purpose to gauge whether it is worth responding or discerning that an idea has already been formed and it may not be wise to respond at all. Furthermore, my culture does not allow me to talk over one another, so silence when someone is talking is a sign of honor and respect. I guess the psalmist says it well, and I paraphrase, if you really want to hear his voice, then you need to be at total standstill or silence to hear what is worthy to hear. This has now even elevated our practice of silence as God made two ears, signaling for me to listen more and speak less. Just saying. Religion has really helped and supported us, Fijians, to sharpen what we already had, but do it now for the love of Christ. So in our indigenous community, we really take to heart what the two most important commandments our Lord Jesus Christ taught us. That is, firstly, to love God, and secondly, to love others like we love ourselves. Really, this is how my community lives from day to day, even in the face of uncertainties. And this is where my faith carries me, and it still is today. Thank you, and God bless us all.
Thank you, Ben, for a very concise story. Really appreciate it. We have a third Christian speaker who's just volunteered, so I would now like to invite Amelia Kava to come up.
Malolele. Before I do my 2 minutes, I would like to say I was invited 20 minutes ago and I just accepted 2 minutes ago. So I'll try to keep it short. My name is Amelia Luana Kava. I was born and raised in Tonga and came here when I was 18. So I was trying to understand what we were talking about, and when I hear everybody's sharing their story, I will share my story based on how I grew up in Tonga. Okay, so Tonga is a little Pacific island. We have our own king and queen, and that's where the volcano was happening not long ago. So I grew up in Tonga, and in Tonga, I believe 80% of Tonga are Christians, and the 20% share the other religions. So I will talk. I was thinking about what I will talk about, so you can understand a little bit of Tonga. And it came to my mind some idea that I will talk about Tonga, especially on a Sunday. What's happened on Sunday in Tonga? So Sunday in Tonga, it's all about church, because it's a country that's a Christian country. On Sunday, there's no shops, no dairy, no businesses open, except for the airport if there's a flight going into Tonga. So on a Sunday, if you wake up in the morning, you hear the bells from different churches. I grew up in a Free Wesleyan church, and it's not so different from the Salvation Army. That's where I am now. And one of the things that I remember about Tonga, on Sunday, as soon as I know how to speak, my parents would put me into the Sunday school. In Sunday school, every Sunday, that starts after the main service. And then I get to learn how to memorize Bible verses from as little as 5 years old. And even until now, I can still remember some of the Bible verses that I learned from an early age. And one thing with Tonga, it's the way we dress to church is different from here, here in New Zealand, or any other country, because we get to wear our tradition dress. So with us female, we don't wear long pants. We wear our, it's like a skirt, but there's a skirt and it's a long dress. And then we wear our tapa around our waist. And that's how we respect our culture goes with our belief as a Christian. And men, they don't wear pants. They do wear their own, like a skirt, but that's for men only, with a shirt. And again, a tapa or a ta'awala around the waist. In a church, we don't dance. We're not really good in dancing, but people love to sing. And we don't have much of instruments that we have here in New Zealand, but we use our voice and we use our hands a lot. We clap and then we raise our hand up, but mostly our voice. So with us back in the island, it's like it's natural to us to good in singing or to just know how to sing. When I joined the Salvation Army, I joined one of the worship team because I love singing. And that's because that's from how I brought up. Singing is one of the main things that we express our belief as a Christian back in the island. And the other thing that I would like to share, growing up as a Christian in Tonga, is Sunday. It's all about not just church, but it's also our sharing a kai. So if you're in Tonga, Sunday you can smell the neighbor's hangi, and we call it in Tonga omu. So pretty much all of each family, they do their cooking. You dig the soil up, and then you do the fire, and when it's hot enough, and then you put the food, and then you put stuff to cover that and the soil on top, and then leave that for half an hour. People normally do that before they get ready to go to church. So when church finished, they come home, it's cooked and it's ready for them too. And it's really, really beautiful. And one thing I remember about it, when we do the omu or the hangi, we always share with our neighbors. What we have, we share, we make a plate and we give it to, if we have four neighbors around our house, that's four plates to go around. And they do the same too. Whatever they have, they share it to us and the rest of the neighbors. And that's beautiful. It's kind of give me courage, and it's kind of build me and make me how I became Salvation Army. In Salvation Army, it's so similar to the Free Wesleyan Church where I grew up in my childhood. And I grew up, my parents were Christian. My great-grandparents were Christian. But my choice being a Christian was based on me personally, with my personal experience. But I believe that what they taught me when I was a childhood and when I grew up helped me to the way to who I am today. So hopefully that's make up to 2 minutes. Maybe next time we invite you earlier, I'll prepare something much better for you guys to share. But that's all. Thank you.
Right. Well, a special thank you to the Christians for really interesting stories. We now move on to the Muslims, and I would like to invite Wing to come up and be our first Muslim speaker.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Kia ora, ni hao, good evening, peace and blessings to everyone here. My name is Wayne. I would like to thank the Wellington Abrahamic Faith Council for giving me this opportunity to talk about the diversity in our community, in the religious community. Since this is a 3-minute talk, and lucky you or poor you, this is my first public engagement, so be easy on me. Okay, I will try to stick to the script and the time given and not deviate, which I sometimes tend to. As I said, my name is Wayne. I was originally from Malaysia and was born to a non-Muslim Chinese household. I have 3 siblings and I'm the 3rd in the family. I have been in New Zealand since 1988. I'm a software developer by profession, so I'm very comfortable sitting in front of a computer than standing in front of an audience. Okay. I've always been agnostic during my younger years. I've been to many places of worship in Malaysia, so finding God has always been in me. So it's like my pursuit for happiness. I came to Islam when I was in Wellington and when I was 40. I am a revert or a convert, some may call it. I've been a Muslim for relatively a long time, so don't try to guess my age. I've been a Muslim. By being a Muslim, I have inherited a family of 1.9 billion members. So I'm always welcome to any of the Muslims' home for a meal or two. Alhamdulillah, please be to God, the Almighty. My first fear of coming to Islam was the forbidden food, which is pork. But there are other meat and healthy diet I can consume. So God has forbidden pork consumption for Muslim for a good reason, and I must abide to it. And being a part of that is part of being a Muslim. I can do without alcohol because I know it is harming to my health. Alcohol used to make me a superhero, but with much regret the day after. So to me, alcohol does more harm than good. I can do without gambling as well because I don't have much luck with gambling. I always tend to lose. And my other fear was Ramadan, which is the fasting month. I'm okay with not having food, but water is something that I find it very hard initially. Then I realized the significance of fasting, which I don't have the luxury of time to go in detail. Anyway, I managed to get over the fear when I know millions had done it in the past, and I'm no different from or above any other Muslims in the past and present. Some kids as young as 7 can manage it, so why can't I? So the fear has disappeared, has been removed from me. Now, the second part is, the second thing I fear of is prayer. Praying 5 times a day may seem to be a daunting task, a mission impossible. But if you think about it, prayers is good for you. It helps you to be connected to God. It keeps you away from vice and mischief. In New Zealand, employers respect your religious obligations. Furthermore, each prayer usually takes about 5 to 10 minutes, just like having a coffee break. I can pray in the meditation room, quiet room, or well-being room. Most organizations here in New Zealand have these facilities. So prayer is no longer become an issue for me. So when you are determined to fulfill your religious obligations, Allah or God will make ease for you. He will clear any obstacles for you, and I always believe in that. Okay. Now, how Islam is similar to my previous belief system. My previous religion taught me to do good. Islam taught me to do good. Essentially, they are the same on the surface. I still celebrate Chinese New Year with my friends and family. I still do a lot of this, my Chinese culture things. And how is it different from my previous belief? How is Islam different from my previous belief? Same, but different. I have a clearer understanding of God and what is required of me as a Muslim. Doing good as commanded by God is not the same as doing good commanded by the majority. Man-made virtue will change according to the majority. And man-made rules will change over time. Man-made values can be politically motivated, swayed, or manipulated. Man-made rules cannot stand the test of time. Whatever your belief system is, don't go to the extreme, or you will be extremely frustrated, extremely angry, and extremely bitter. Life is too short for such rancor. Do good for the love of God. Pray before you are prayed upon. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Wayne, especially for your message of moderation, which I think is contained in all of our religions. Now I'd like to invite Auntie Jean to come up. No, that's already on.
I'm so much easier. I just turned 90 last calendar. Well, I had something here we were told 3 minutes. Better now. Breathe. I'm originally from Birmingham, UK, and I went through the Nazi Blitz in Birmingham. We were the worst bombed city in Birmingham. When I was 10 years old, I went to local Bourneville Cadbury School. This was the local primary school, and we were just sitting, well, we were 1942, we bombing in 1940. So we were brought out of bed every night to take God. And I have been through all those bombs in Birmingham and suburbs. So what's bringing this developing now into my short talk with you is that I always took the religious instruction classes at the school. And these classes were always either about the Old Testament or the New Testament. However, this particular day, the teacher said, "Today we are going to talk about Islam." We never heard of Islam. Well, I certainly have. So he began to tell us the teachings of Islam, which I could see that something happened that day, because you can imagine we were children, only small, 8-year-old, and we've been all through that. This was only a year later, a couple of years, so I was 10, and these bombs came when I was 8. And we were still there, the war was still going on. Big stories about that, but that's for another time. But so that's how we were, and we were pulled out of bed. We had been pulled out of bed, so that meant that no sleep, but we went to school the next day. Now, this is very interesting, because what has happened here now, with the lockdown, children haven't been able to go to school. So we had no choice. We had to go, we attended school. And because the Nazis thought that because of all this stress, we would be demoralized. That's the sleep deprivation. So this day, we listened to this and I thought, how come we are sitting in this place with all this debris? Obviously the war's going on, nothing's done about the debris. And so I walked out of there. Then they used to show films, you know, at the concert hall just nearby. And school films, this was the school. So we went and watched this film, and it was called The Thief of Baghdad. So this was a very oriental kind of film. Now after this, I came home and I never forgot that. And this peace that came over me that day, I can tell you, I was a little girl, but I never forgot. Then 10 years later, I was obeying my father, taking a young lady who was a friend, daughter of a friend of his. And my dad said, "Will you take her wherever he was?" I said, "Do I have to?" "Yes, you have to." I obeyed him and I went. There I met a person who was a Muslim. And from that day, it didn't just happen like that, but we were together for 55 years. In between there, of course, in the early days, I hadn't forgotten all about this, and it seemed that this was the way that I too had been brought up. It was just so amazing. And so this is it. So you can see that we have lived together. Now, how did we live together? And I'm going to answer part of your question. We live together because religion is the same, like in any. You just ought to be good. And what are we here for? We are being tested here to see if we are good enough to go along to the next stage. Okay. Actually, I don't want to go on too far because I don't want to use my time. I'm a writer, I'm a secretary by profession, and now I don't take anything down for other people. I write for myself. Now, unfortunately, lost my husband 50 maybe 16 years ago. Before then, I'd started to write, that we wrote books together. So I'd like to just read this. I think you'll be interested. You know a bit about pageants lately with the when your day looks dull, now you could just think my day was dull that day, and I went into the class and listened to that, and suddenly I don't know what happened, but that was it. So when your day looks dull and things go wrong, what must we do to keep marching along? I'll tell you what I think is best. In order that when I pass this test, try counting your blessings, however small, but enough to make you still stand tall. And say, there must be a God, or I'd be sure to fall, like me at the moment. Believe me. Okay. If you've fallen already, try to look back and see your mistake. Perhaps losing your family, probably not by distance, but by your ways of living. Always remember, it could have been worse. Perhaps that dollar could have been your purse. So, but for God's mercy, in all that you do, each day that we live could be disastrous for you. All of us know deep in our heart that someone is watching us acting our part in a production never repeated. For our life is a pageant at which angels are seated. These angels are writing in a large book. It's our story which the angels can't cook. Our life is a recipe given by God. And baked to perfection in a lifetime's hard blood. That's it.
And our final speaker for tonight is Muhammad Mohammed. So please come up, Muhammad. Thank you.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. Now, my name is Mohammed, and my last name is Muhammad. And sometimes it confuses people because they don't know which one is my first and which one is my last. And the only difference is E and U. And that actually makes the difference in terms of the meaning of that name. I came from originally Somalia, otherwise known as the Horn of Africa. I have been in New Zealand half of my life, and I left my country when I was very young. And tonight, when I was told, you know, to speak about diversity, I was thinking, you know, this is one of the words that we have actually acquired here, because where we come from, we are not diverse. Somalia is one of the countries in the world where you have almost, you can say, in any Muslim country, we have 100% Muslim population. No other place in the world that can claim that. Even though some challenges, some people challenge and say you are 99.9%. In that sense, we also have the Somali language only. We don't have other tribal language like other African countries. So we have the same language, same religion, and same customs, which means within Somalia, you don't have diversity as such. So this word was new to us when we came here. But first, let me mention diversity in Islam, what the Holy Book of Islam says about diversity, the Quran itself. Islamic religion respects diversity and originates in the Quran. While describing many of Allah's signs, the Quran, the book, the Holy Book of Islam states, "The diversity of your languages and your colors indeed in that are signs for those of knowledge." Although the Quran is generally only considered canon in the original Arabic, this verse suggests that God intended people to speak many other languages and exist as different cultures. The Quran further elaborates further in another chapter, "O mankind, we have created you into nations and tribes that you might come to know one another and not deny one another. Indeed, God, Allah, says that mankind is not only destined to exist as diverse peoples, but that we as humans should welcome this and actively try to understand people who are different from ourselves." Now, as I said previously, coming from Somalia with very little diversity within our own country and coming to New Zealand was an eye-opening. And now where we worship here at our mosque, we have people who come from more than 50 or 60 countries, and even the different speakers that we have heard from our Muslim community tonight come from different parts of the world. And we often see how diverse we are. Yes, we have the same faith, we believe the same religion, we worship the same God, but there are so many other things that we don't share in terms of where we come from, depending on what part of the world that we come from. One of my Kiwi friends, whose name is Bita, used to tell me when the first Somali refugees came here many years ago, 1994, because he was living here in Newtown, and all he said people were coming out to the streets to watch the Somali woman who was actually wearing the long veils, bright colored, you know, very bright colored, and the and they were wearing the long veil and hijab. And if you are non-Muslim, possibly you will think every Muslim is the same in how they dress and how they eat. But if you are within the Muslim community, you can immediately feel, you know, who is from Pakistan and who is from Africa, or who is from Somalia, depending on. Even though the ladies, for example, wear the hijab, still the difference can be identified if you actually look into that. The other diversity within us is the way we celebrate events, for example, marriage, for example. It's not very unusual where we come from to have arranged marriage, for example, or to marry a woman that you have not seen until that night when you are getting married. I know that's very unusual for some people, But for different cultures, it might be something that's unheard of. But it still happens in some parts of our countries. And my current role as the secretary of Iman here at the Kilbeni Mosque, I often see the differences within our Muslim communities. And sometimes there are more cultural, these are more cultural things than religion itself. And we learn from each other. And we, I can say, I have the privilege of learning all these differences from different cultures that I find myself in. So how that unique diversity that we find here in New Zealand, Muslims, has influenced people who are not where we come from, but our children who are growing up here. They had the opportunity of actually learning all these different diverse cultures within the Muslim community. Whereas where we come from, we didn't have that. So we had the monoculture. Because for us, religion was not something that you only do Fridays, for example. Religion was something that was always with you. The way you greet other people, the way you eat, the way you dress, the way you engage other people, the way you behave. So coming to another country where there's so multi, other religions and other beliefs, other cultures, was really an eye-opening and learning for people like us who come from that part of the world. For our children who are growing up, they have the opportunity of learning from all this diversity within their community, so they don't have to travel anywhere to learn different culture. So I think what I can say, religion for me as a personally is it's very hard to say how it, because it's part of our life on a daily basis. Last week I had a student visit our mosque, and they were asking questions like, you know, the prayer times and how we pray and all this. Why do we pray five times a day, for example? And they will not understand why we pray five times every day. And we were trying to explain to them, you know, this is what we have to do without without asking questions, because this is what Allah, God, required us to do for our own benefit. So it's not something that I can decide, no, you know, I'm not going to do this week, I'm going to do it next, you know, the following week. The other thing that previous speakers mentioned was Ramadan, for example, how we celebrate and gather eat days and celebrations. So I think that there's a lot of things that we can learn from one another within our Muslim diversity, but also from other people who are non-Muslims. So thank you for the opportunity, and I wish you all the best. Thank you.